From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll speak with historians about how they're documenting the stories of Latinx Wisconsinites past and present. Then we'll hear from a Milwaukee judge about his experience battling COVID-19 as part of our Pandemic Reflection series.
I come to a point where, you know, if this was my time, this was my time, right? And I just wanted to make sure that my family was okay, my family was all right. So I just basically just prayed and said, please take care of my family.
Plus, we'll look at this year's Doors Open, which includes new virtual walking tours through neighborhoods like Silver City, and learn what makes them unique.
I love the diversity in culture, age, ethnicity, and you really see that as you're walking around through the neighborhood, through the people that you see, the types of artworks that are around.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with our celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month. The history and documentation of Latinx people in Wisconsin hasn't always been complete. But a group called the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective is trying to change that by documenting and empowering Latinx history. Founding members Tess Arenas and Sergio Gonzalez are collaborating with public historians like Margarita Sandoval Scari to collect the stories of Latinx Wisconsinites. One historical figure you may have heard of is Rafael Baez. He's the first Latinx person recorded to have lived in Milwaukee. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang takes a look into Baez's story, the work of the collective, and how Milwaukee's Latinx community can trace back its roots.
Outside of Bruce Guadalupe Community School in Walker's Point, there's a mural that shows the history of Latinx Milwaukeeans. If you look closely in the first panel, you'll see Rafael Baez. He was the first recorded Latinx Milwaukeean and is a significant part of our city's history. I spoke with a group of Wisconsin Latinx historians, Tess Arenas, Margarita Sandoval Scari, and Sergio Gonzalez, who are all working to document and preserve the histories of Latinx Wisconsinites. First, we'll hear from Sergio Gonzalez, an assistant professor of Latinx studies at Marquette University. He helps give a rundown of who Baez was.
Rafael Baez was born in Puebla, Mexico in the 1860s. And from a young age, he was a bit of a prodigy when it came to music. And there was an opera company from the United States that was doing a tour of Mexico, which was pretty common in the 19th century. And they were looking for some local talent to come and play with them. And people kept saying his name, so he did. And when they finished their tour in Mexico, they invited him to come back to the United States with them. And he did a tour through the country. And for some reason that historians have never been able to figure out, when he decided to settle down, he didn't go back to Mexico. He decided to stay here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Baez went on to marry fellow musician Mary Schoen, a German immigrant in 1889. He stayed in Milwaukee for the rest of his life until his death in 1931.
But he started off by being a choir director and an organist for some of the biggest churches and synagogues in the city of Milwaukee. And then his life really picked up from there, and he had a lot of different occupations after that. He became a music tutor for some of the city's kind of elites. So they would send their kids to go and learn how to play specifically piano, but also violin, which was his favorite instrument. He became a composer, and he actually published a few pieces. He became kind of a bit player in local politics, a member of the Democratic Party. And then, you know, really interesting to me as a professor at Marquette University, he became Marquette University's first documented Mexican and Latinx professor. He became a professor of music and theory at the turn of the century. Rafael Baez is the first documented person, right? It's the first person we can kind of identify in the archives and the sources. But of course, we would imagine that there were people who came before him, either directly from Mexico or kind of migrated from different parts of the Southwest. It's just that historically, it's been very difficult to find those traces in the kind of established archives, institutional records, and papers. And so we could assume that there are people who came before him as well. After Rafael Baez, there's kind of a bit of a lull in the number of people coming from Latin America to Wisconsin. And it's not until the 1920s that we start to see a large influx of people arriving from Latin American countries. And the big reason, there's a couple of big reasons. One is because the United States Congress functionally shuts off immigration from Europe, which means that all of those big companies in Milwaukee that depended on the cheap and controllable labor of European immigrants now needed to find new sources of workers. And so they looked often to Mexico, which was not included in those quotas that had cut off immigration in the 1920s. And so companies like the Pfister and Vogel Tannery and Harnisch-Fager and other factories and foundries in the cities began to recruit specifically young Mexican men up to Milwaukee to work in low-paying, back-breaking, really kind of rough positions. And these Mexican men would come up, and when they found that there were good opportunities, they would send word back home and they would bring their families up. And so beginning in the 1920s, you start to see the development of a small, what we call a colonia, a little colony on the south side of Milwaukee, right around those factories and foundries. That story really develops throughout the 20th century to become a much more diverse and wide-ranging story. In the 1940s and 1950s, we can look out into the agricultural field outside of Milwaukee, where Texas Mexican workers, known as Tejanos, begin to arrive in the state in large numbers. In the 1950s, about 15,000 Tejanos would come to the state every single year to work in anything and everything you can imagine being picked in Wisconsin's agricultural fields. In the 1950s, we have Puerto Rican migrant workers arriving directly from the island and from other cities like Chicago to come and work in our factories and foundries. The 1960s, Cuban refugees arriving, many of them coming from Miami when the city becomes kind of too overpacked with people, not enough economic opportunities, and they come to Milwaukee looking for better lives. In the 1980s, you have Central Americans often arriving as refugees from places like El Salvador and Guatemala, looking for a space of safe harbor, and Milwaukee religious organizations help them find it here. And that story kind of develops and develops. And so the thing that's really interesting about Milwaukee is that Milwaukee has really almost always had a very diverse Latinx population. It's never been just one. It's not been Mexican or Puerto Rican or Cuban. It's always been kind of this wide kaleidoscope of different peoples.
Gonzalez is a founding member of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective, a group of scholars and community researchers in communities across the state that are documenting Wisconsin Latinx history and are committed to the stewardship of Latinx archival collections. The collective is working for 5 years to document Latinx history in partnership with UW-Madison, the Wisconsin History Collective, and Chicana Bordomiudasa, Digital Memory Collective.
And so I've been really proud and fortunate to work with this growing group of historians across our state who have all been brought under this kind of central goal, which is to re-envision Wisconsin history as one that is inclusive of the Latinx story, or Latinx stories in the plural. We're working under the direction of, I think, one of the greatest public scholars that we have working in Wisconsin, Dr. Tess Arenas, who did really tireless work at UW-Madison and UW System for years, and has now given up her retirement to really bring us all together and to gather the resources to preserve these stories.
Tess Arenas is the founder and the lead of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective. She is also known for her work at the Somos Latinas History Project, a project that documents the significant and largely hidden contributions of Latinas in Wisconsin.
The collective was founded in January of 2020, and it's an offshoot of my work for documenting Latina activists over the age of 50, which is known as the Somos Latina Digital History Collection. I take an appreciative inquiry approach to these interviews. And these are not journalistic exposés where we're trying to dig up the dirt on an individual's life. We're trying to set the historical record straight about what Latinx people bring to a community and bring to our state. And we approach our oral history interviews from that perspective. What have you done? What would you like to share? What words of wisdom do you have for others who want to do similar things? And by educating others about our contributions and our possibilities, we can remove barriers, attitudinal barriers and behavioral barriers to people, Latinx people flourishing in this state.
Gonzalez credits the work of local Latinx public historians for spearheading the documentation of the Wisconsin Latinx community.
The work of kind of documenting this history has been a long and arduous process, and it's one that I am very thankful to be a part of, but there have been many people who came before me who have been doing this work. either whether it was families in the 1920s and 30s who were preserving their own family's histories, kind of leaving those trails for future historians to find, or beginning in the 1970s and 80s, public historians who perhaps didn't have official positions at universities and they weren't classically trained as historians with PhDs, but they had a real passion for finding this history and making sure that it was a part of our state's register.
Margarita Sandoval Scari is a retired Milwaukee Public Schools teacher and librarian. She also started the genealogy tent at Mexican Fiesta, where festival goers can learn the ropes of tracing their familial lineage.
I'm not used to being called a public historian. The genealogy for me started 15, 16, 17 years ago that I started the booth at Mexican Fiesta. And one of the first largest exhibits that I became involved in with were the early Mexicans that came from Mexico to Milwaukee. And my father is one of them. He's called one of los primeros, or the first. I was born into a Mexican family. We grew up actually singing. My sisters and I were seven children in total. We would listen to the albums Trio Los Panchos, Edie Gourmet, and Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, of course.
Que se quede el infinito sin estrellas, o que pierda el ancho mar su inmensidad, pero el negro de tus ojos que no muera.
Margarita enjoys showing others how to document their family's lineage. She recommends you start at where she knows best, your local library.
You can use Ancestry at no charge at the Milwaukee Public Library because they have purchased it so that people can come to the Milwaukee Public Library and sit in the library and use Ancestry for free. If your family is from, let's say, New York, you may also want to go to their websites for their libraries to see, because the libraries now have scanned so many types of other documents, maps, and charts that you may not find anywhere else. And you can get in touch with the librarians there. Your librarians are your friends.
Her next tip, interview your family and keep those documents.
If you're really a good genealogist, you will be connected with some family members that you may know or may not know, and you will have to take a visit to whatever foreign country it might be, or a visit to whatever local state in the United States it might be. If your parents are living, you are most fortunate, and hopefully they have some good memories and good stories to tell. You can tape record these stories or just take notes. You want to interview perhaps in their home, or you bring them, like I have done, to my home, and then I feed them a meal, and they usually don't say no. After that, you're going to say, okay, now I just met somebody new through maybe a website and you've been in touch with your relatives. So now you need to have a visit, a genealogy visit. It was a number of years ago that 20 members from my family, we went to Mexico, sisters and their husbands, my husband, daughter, friends of hers, we all went, and we went to Zacatecas. That was where we did our search. We went to La Estancia de los Delgadillos, where my father was from, as well Rancho San Pablo, where my mother was from. And we saw so many wonderful things. Cemeteries, make sure you always go to cemeteries and take photographs. Interview your family members, take notes, or if they will allow, you take sound recordings and you ask them about the past. And so many people are very free to give information. After our visits to Mexico, then I came back and just continued the same work. As genealogists, we collect documents. That's the proof of things. So you want to collect birth, marriage, baptismal documents, death documents, cemetery documents, maybe high school documents. It's our history. It's our families, our early relatives who came to Milwaukee. It's important that we educate our young children growing up so that they can be proud of their heritage.
Our history is of no value unless our children know about it.
That's Tess Arenas again from the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective.
These young people come up, they understand the integral part Latinx play in the state economy, the culture, morals, and values of the state. My dream is that the materials that we, our collective members produce are used in educational settings from K-12 to post-secondary. We're looking at traveling exhibits for schools and museums and local history organizations and curriculum. Our goal is to continually share what's been developed across the state.
History is a question of narratives, and it's a question of power and a question of actors. And so we have to think about who has historically had the opportunity to have their voice included in the narratives that we tell each other, and the way in which those narratives often color things beyond just the history books that we write and the stories we tell around the dinner table, but they have real political and economic ramifications. And so, but I really hope that the work we're doing is going to have large ramifications beyond just an academic endeavor. For me, the joy that I find in doing this work is to know that there are scattered stories across our city. And it's the job of me as a historian and the students that I work with and all the public historians who have been doing this work for decades to accumulate the stories, to preserve those stories, and then most importantly, to share those stories with the rest of Wisconsin so that Wisconsinites across the state understand that Latinx history is Wisconsin history. And that if we don't understand Latinx history, we can't understand the story of our state.
Tess Arenas is the founder and lead of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective. Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor of Latinx studies at Marquette University. And Margarita Sandoval Scari is a retired Milwaukee public schools teacher and librarian. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. We're celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month all month long here at WUWM. And you can find more coverage at wuwm.com/Hispanic Heritage. We are also celebrating our fall member drive, and you can call 877-583-0309 or head to wuwm.com/give with your donation. Right now, we have a very special offer here from Classy Girl Cupcakes. If you give right now during Lake Effect, you'll be automatically entered into a drawing to win a cupcake party tray from Classy Girl Cupcakes. The tray includes 26 cupcakes and your choice of up to 4 flavors. There are gluten-free and vegan options and more than 25 flavors to choose from, like almond, cookies and cream, or salted caramel fudge, among many others. A contribution is not necessary to be entered into the drawing, but it would be greatly appreciated. If you give right now before 1 o'clock, you're automatically entered. Call 877-583-0309. That's 877-583-0309. You can also head to our website, wuwm.com/give, or head to our app and just press that big red donate button. If you've been listening for a while, you've probably heard a few of these membership drives. And we know that sometimes it can be tough to take that first step to making a donation. Is it really that important? How much money should I give? Do I have the time to actually do it? And of course, does it really matter? And yeah, it does matter. Your support, combined with the support of all the other WUWM members, makes amazing things happen here on WUWM. And it only takes a minute to contribute. You can choose the amount that's right for you. A great way to join WUWM for the first time is by making a $5 a month sustaining gift. And when you do, you'll discover that special pride of being a WUWM member. Make a difference right now. Join WUWM today at wuwm.com/give. Or you can call 877-583-0309. Or you can click that big red donate button in the app. Now, here's a message from someone who you don't usually hear on the air, but you hear her work every day. Lake Effect's executive producer, Becky Mortensen.
I'm Lake Effect executive producer, Becky Mortensen, asking for your support during the Fall Member Drive. If you love the local stories and intriguing conversations we bring you here on Lake Effect, then make your contribution today. What you give helps us bring you the great programming you hear on WUWM, like Lake Effect. The number to call is 877-583-0309. Thank you for your support.
Coming up on Lake Effect in about 15 minutes, we'll look at a cherished annual event here in Milwaukee, Doors Open. We'll learn about some of the sites on the list this year and its new virtual tours through a few Milwaukee neighborhoods. But before that, we'll bring you the first conversation in a new series, Pandemic Reflections. We'll hear from Milwaukee Municipal Judge Derek Mosley about his experience battling COVID-19 and his philosophical takeaways from the pandemic. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The coronavirus pandemic has been around for about a year and a half, and we're still adjusting to life with COVID-19. The number of people who have died from the virus is staggering. But there are also stories of growth and resilience through this experience. We'll be sharing some of those stories in our new series called Pandemic Reflections. We'll be speaking with people about their experiences and what they've learned from this difficult time. We'll start this series off with a conversation with Milwaukee Municipal Judge Derek Mosley. He faced a 12-day battle with COVID-19 last year in the ICU at Frederick Hospital. WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with him about what he experienced and what he learned.
It made me appreciate just how precious life is. And people say that all the time, that they understand what that means, but you really don't understand what it means until you're actually fighting for your life. And, you know, what made the COVID experience so unique is that you're fighting for your life alone. Everybody who's there is a stranger. And so the biggest fear for me was, you know, dying alone. You know, being in a room, in a bed, and taking your last breath surrounded, you know, by people who don't even know who you are. And so it made me really appreciate just how precious that is and how important it is to, you know, to tell people you love them, to be engaged with family and friends, because things are just so delicate.
And, you know, you can be a judge, you can be a political leader, you can be an Olympic athlete, and yet none of us are invincible, right? People sometimes don't realize that until they have a big health scare. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, you're perfect when you said that, you know, and I'll just take my experience as a judge. You know, you go into a courtroom and everybody's looking at you and listening to you, and what you say goes, right? And so you go from that environment, going into an environment where you control nothing, right? In the courtroom, I control everything that happens in that courtroom. But when you're sitting laying in the ICU and, you know, the doctors aren't even coming into the room because of how precarious the situation is, they're calling you on the phone in the room to talk, you realize you control nothing. And so you are at the, you know, you trust your life to strangers who fortunately are well equipped to handle it. And You know, the strangest thing is, and I've really appreciated it now, is breathing. You don't think about that. You know, I only think about breathing heavy when I'm running or I'm exercising. But I was doing nothing. I was just sitting in a laying in a bed and couldn't breathe. And so it felt as if you were actually running a marathon or just ran a marathon, the way you're gasping like that for air, trying to get your lungs back into shape. But you're just sitting in a bed. And so it makes you appreciate breaths. In fact, to this day, I will just stop and just take a series of deep breaths because I was unable to do it then.
That is amazing. You know, you didn't end up being a long hauler, which is great, right? But there were some sort of residual imprints that whole experience had on you. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. Yeah. So the initial one, which is no joke, is the, they called it like COVID fog or sort of like a brain fog. And it just seemed like things just weren't clear. Initially when I returned home from the ICU, it was just things that I'd said something and, I'd said it again. And they're like, you just said that. And I'm like, I really didn't recall saying that. Or people telling me something. And I was like, I don't remember you telling me that. And so that was really scary to me as a judge, because my whole life is about remembering what people say. Right. And so that was scary. And, I learned a little bit later, and I didn't realize it, when you're in the ICU, the only sounds in that room are the beeps from the machines. And there was one particular beep that had a pitch that if my blood oxygen dropped too low, it went off. And I would jump up and start taking deep breaths to try to get more oxygen into my blood. And that noise, that sound, is similar to my microwave when it beeps when it's ready. And so I would be making something in the microwave and I hear that beep and it would make me jump. And to this day, I still have that kind of effect. And I found out there are other people who were in the ICU that had this same trauma, if you will. In fact, that's what I was part of a study at Johns Hopkins, and they were talking about. It's sort of like a emotional stress, like you get if you were post-traumatic stress is what they called it. And so you would hear a beep or you hear a sound that reminded you of the ICU and just put you back on edge. And I still had that for quite some time. I'm kind of over that now, and I'm over the brain fog, but I still, to this day, I always have on my person a blood oxygen meter, and I will put my finger in it and just to make sure, because when you see that number decrease before your eyes, it's quite frightening.
So it's almost like you've gotten your life handed back to you twice, or maybe more than twice, if I don't know all the times. But does that make you feel like, man, I'm here for a reason. I better make the most of it. Like, how has that affected you?
Yeah. You know, so I was in the room, and before I actually got the iPad, and the doctor had called me on the phone. I could see him, but he didn't come into the room. And he called me on the phone and said, you know, you're at this weird spot where we've seen patients progressively get better, or we've just seen them bottom out. And at this moment, because remember, I had COVID in March of last year, so this was pretty fresh. And he said, we don't know why, but some people just completely bottom out at this point. So you're at this stage, so we're going to watch you. And, you know, and so he hung up the phone, and it's dark and you hear the beeps, and it all sunk in for me at that moment about how precious life is. And so when the nurse came in with the actual iPad, and I got to see my family and we talked, then she left with the iPad and I was alone again. And you're just with your thoughts all alone. And I just said to myself, you know, just preparing myself that at this point I was like, I had come to the point where, you know, if this was my time, this was my time. Right. And I just wanted to make sure that my family was okay. And my family was all right. And so I just basically just prayed and said, you know, if it's my time, it's my time, right? But please take care of my family. And that's all I thought about. And yeah, it's weird to get to that point where you just kind of like come to grips with, it's out of my hands, right? And so, and that was weird for me as a judge, because problems are what I solve every single day. And so someone presents a problem, I try to come up with a solution. And so that's what made this so hard for me and so difficult to comprehend, is there was no solution that I could come up with because it was completely out of my hands. And that's what made it even more frightening. But made me realize I got work to do, Mayan. I still have work to do here.
Well, that feeling of powerlessness, how have you been processing it since then? Has it changed the way you judge? Has it changed the way you live any parts of your life?
Yeah, it's, it's really easy when you, because we're a pretty high volume court, so we get a lot of cases in. And I've always prided myself that no matter if I have 150 cases on my docket that morning, right? To me, it's 150 cases. But to that person who comes into the court, that case that they have is the most important case I'm doing all day. And I really put that back into perspective for me, because when you're high volume, it's case after case after case. But when it comes down to that person, that individual, and problems that people have, and then the pandemic just made it more difficult for people. So yes, it's changed the way I judge, in the sense that it's refocused me and put me back in line of what I thought I was doing all the time, but it made me realize that maybe I needed to revisit, and I have.
And what about in your personal life? Have you sought out any sources of wisdom or faith practices or stories or anything that you've held on to that have helped you?
Yeah, you know what's helped the most are other people who have gone through the same situation. So for me, it's unique because I had a kidney transplant. And when you have a kidney transplant, they literally give you an itinerary from the moment you walk into the hospital to the moment you walk out about what's going to happen to you, right? So you walk in, you get prepped for surgery, you get to say, see you soon to your donor, right? And all these things, you get in the bed and they take your temperature, you know what's going to happen. They have an all itinerary, right? This, you got in there and everybody just kind of looked around like, well, we're going to try this. We'll see how this works. And it becomes really scary. And so I was taking those two experiences and I found that it's been really therapeutic to talk to other people who have been in the ICU, talk to people who are in that same situation. Because people think they understand, like, oh, I get it. I was in the hospital and I had my appendix out. And I'm like, yeah, I did that. I had the transplant. I've been in the hospital. But this is a little bit different. This is not only life and death, but it's completely out of your control. And so I found talking to other people who've gone through that experience has been very cathartic.
And one of the things you're doing now is trying to convince people to get the vaccine, people that may be wary of medical systems and processes. Have you found that you're able to connect to people explaining based on what you've been through?
Yeah, I have. And I get it. And I know that as far as someone who's African-American, that we have a pretty, jaded view of historically of medicine and how we've been treated through the medical system. However, I think that we have learned. The medical system has learned this issue that Black people have or people of color have with medicine. And, what I try to tell people is this. Despite the fact that it might seem to you that everything's being rushed and everything, it might seem like they're not dotting their I's and crossing their T's. That's because we live in this world where everything is accessible. And it was explained to me the best by a doctor who said, we call this scientific method. And generally, you don't see it. You just see the finished product. But because we live in this 24-hour news cycle and everybody's trying to get stories, you are actually witnessing scientific method happen firsthand. And you have with scientific method, things work, things don't work until you find the perfect mix that makes it work. And so because there's been so much information coming out and they say one thing and then something else comes out, use masks, don't use masks, use two masks, whatever it may be. That's the scientific method until we figure out what's going on. And so it doesn't make it's not that they don't know what they're doing. It's not that they're just flying by the seat of their pants. That's scientific method. And for the first time in human history, we are watching it happen right before our eyes, because normally that happens in laboratories. You're not familiar with it. And so trust the process. And I will tell you that I had no side effects from the vaccine. No one in my family had any side effects from the vaccine. And I will tell you that having COVID and being in the ICU, there is nothing like that experience. And I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. The breaths. I talked to you earlier about breaths and how I all the time, all day, I will take deep breaths just to feel I can do it. Because I went from taking deep breaths to just breathing like... That's how I breathed every day for 12 days because my lungs couldn't fill up with any air. And so, trust me, that vaccine is a lot better than that feeling, no doubt about it.
Well, Judge Derek Mosley, thanks so much for chatting on WUWM.
Oh, Vion, thank you.
Judge Derek Mosley is presiding judge of the Milwaukee Municipal Courts and a COVID-19 survivor. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver as part of our series Pandemic Reflections. You can listen for more in this series over the next several weeks. If you're just tuning in, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and we're right in the middle of our fall member drive here at WUWM. You can call 877-583-0309. Or head to wuwm.com/give with your donation. All this hour, we have a very special offer from Classy Girl Cupcakes. If you give right now until 1 o'clock, you'll be automatically entered into a drawing to win a cupcake party tray from Classy Girl Cupcakes. The tray includes 26 cupcakes and your choice of up to 4 flavors. There are gluten-free options, there are vegan options, and more than 25 flavors to choose from. You can have things like cookies and cream, salted caramel fudge, almond, lemon, and many others. Contribution is not necessary to be entered into the drawing, but would be greatly appreciated. And if you give right now before 1 o'clock, you're automatically entered. Call 877-583-0309. You can head to our website, wuwm.com/give, or head to our app and just press that big red donate button. Now here is a message from our newest producer, Mallory Chang.
Hi, I'm Lake Effect producer Mallory Chang. On Lake Effect, we dive deep into conversations and topics that are important to you and your community. And we couldn't be doing this without your continued support. Your contribution helps make Lake Effect and all the programs you hear on WUWM possible. Become a member today. Give us a call at 877-583-0309 or go online to wuwm.com/give.
Coming up, we'll look at this year's Doors Open event and its new virtual walking tours through different Milwaukee neighborhoods. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWN, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee is filled with fascinating historic buildings, but we rarely get a chance to explore them. This weekend, you'll be able to do just that with the annual Doors Open event through Historic Milwaukee. This year, Doors Open is expanding with virtual tours of several unique neighborhoods around the city. These tours will be an in-depth look at the businesses, art, and community spaces that define these neighborhoods. I'm joined now by Grace Feuer, Events Director for Historic Milwaukee, and Lydia Villazayas, the Community Outreach Manager for Silver City Neighborhood with VIA CDC, formerly known as Layton Boulevard West Neighbors. Lydia, Grace, thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you for having me.
One of the big things this year that you have that's new is an app-based walking tour of a few different neighborhoods in Milwaukee. Grace, can you explain how that works?
Sure thing. So anybody with a smartphone can download the Historic Milwaukee app. It is free. This is an app that we developed over the course of the last year as a result of the pandemic so that people would have an opportunity to explore Milwaukee on self-guided tours. So we've developed several up to this point, but this year we're excited for Doors Open to launch three new neighborhood tours. One of them is the Silver City neighborhood, another is Avenues West, and one is Villard Avenue. And again, those are all completely free to take. The Silver City app tour is available in English and Spanish.
Now, I am particularly excited about the Silver City neighborhood. I moved into this neighborhood not too long ago, and I'm, you know, as a new resident, excited to learn more about the area. Lydia, you know all about Silver City. What are you highlighting in this tour?
Well, I wouldn't say all, but yes, I'm also a Silver City neighbor, and I've been working in the neighborhood for 3 years. So we really highlighted a specific corner of Silver City, not the full neighborhood, but just this one corner that has so many amenities, so many green spaces. And we were able to highlight the history of how those spaces came to be in Silver City and like the development of them. And yes, also highlighting the artwork in the neighborhood. There's so much awesome public art. So we were able to highlight that as well.
Now, all three neighborhoods that are going to be highlighted in the app are really interesting neighborhoods. They all have unique aspects to them. Lydia, what do you think makes Silver City a unique neighborhood in Milwaukee?
I love the diversity in culture, age, ethnicity, just like so much diversity throughout the board, like whatever it is. And you really see that as you're walking around through the neighborhood, through the people that you see, the types of artworks that are around, the businesses that it has. So that's really one of my favorite parts, that you really just get to know and see so much beautiful culture, history, just the diversity of it all. And I think the tour is able to highlight that a lot.
Grace, when we look at these other two neighborhoods that are going to be included in these walking tours, what do you think make them unique as we look at, you know, the full range of Milwaukee neighborhoods?
That's a great question. The Near West Side, and specifically Avenues West, which is what this tour focuses on, highlights a lot of really amazing historic architecture in Milwaukee, like the Rave Eagles Ballroom Club and the Pabst Mansion, and some others, and some really great, rich history, stories in history. And again, also a very diverse neighborhood just west of downtown, including Marquette's campus. And Villard Avenue, it has a really amazing history as well. And we're excited that that tour includes a lot of art. Last year, the Neighborhood Business Improvement District was able to commission several new mural artworks that are installed there. So the app takes you on a tour of what they call visual vibes artworks. And the art is amazing. Lots of diverse depictions of the neighborhood as it is now, and a peek at the history of the neighborhood there. One of the murals is on the side of the historic town hall there, and it's now being housed or will be renovated by the Quasimodo Theater Company. So again, that's just a great walk to kind of down history and also talking about future development and plans for the neighborhood there.
You know, Doors Open in general has become such a staple for Milwaukeeans. I think a lot of people have enjoyed looking at these buildings on the inside, especially places that we pass all the time. Of course, last year was a little bit different due to the pandemic. We're, of course, experiencing another kind of spike in the pandemic again. So I'm sure there are people who are going to be participating both virtually and in person. When you look at this year's Doors Open, Grace, Lydia, what are you most excited about?
I'm excited that we are able to host some tours in person. So we'll have about 70 locations that people can visit on September 25th and 26th in person. And that's compared to 180 sites in the past. So it is scaled down. One of the biggest sites that we have that will be new to the program is the historic Grand Theater on Wisconsin Avenue, of course, home to Milwaukee Symphony Center. And we're thrilled that they are using Doors Open to open up their doors for the first time to the general public. And they will have free live performances by the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra that people can experience on the Sunday of Doors Open. So that's absolutely a can't miss. I'm also excited that we have a group of sites that are outdoors. So if people don't want to tour sites indoors, they can check out
Alice's Garden in the Lindsay Heights neighborhood. Black Cat Alley on the east side is a mural, outdoor mural gallery. The Collaborative Farms, which was historically growing power on Milwaukee's northwest side. Schlitz Autobahn will be open for free tours on the Sunday of Doors Open. And Lakeshore State Park will also have guided tours throughout the Saturday of Doors Open. So those are some great ways to get outside and explore Milwaukee. If you are interested in places of worship, we have a couple of really great churches that are open, including the Basilica on Milwaukee's south side that was built in 1896. It's a beautiful space. The interior is just immaculate. And Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church, located on the northwest side closer to Wauwatosa, which is a Frank Lloyd Wright designed church that was built in 1961. So that's just kind of a few ideas and ways that people can interact with Doors Open. I'm also excited that for the first time, we will have a water-themed scavenger hunt this year, and that'll take place virtually from the 25th to October 3rd. People can locate 10 locations throughout Milwaukee and take pictures of those and interact with that on social media. We have some really cool prizes, including a kayak trip that you can win. And that's in partnership with Fund for Lake Michigan. So there's lots of ways to interact with the event, whether virtually or in person.
Yeah, for me, I have been living in Milwaukee for 3 years. And my first year here in 2018, I was able to participate in some of the in-person Doors Open things, which is really nice to help me get to know the city when I first moved here. So I'm just excited that the team at Historic Milwaukee is just finding so many creative ways to allow for different ways of engagement for people, you know, because everyone has different comfort levels. And yeah, so I think that's great. I also am just really excited to see and to have had them reach out to us to do a bilingual tour. I'm a huge advocate for language accessibility throughout the city. I think it's incredibly important. And I think that's a step forward for their organization and just is a good example to show people that it's not that difficult to add language accessibility into your thought process when creating and developing projects.
For sure, especially in Milwaukee, it's a very important component because so much of our community speak a variety of languages.
Indeed. And we're thrilled to be able to offer this tour in English and Spanish. And we hope that it's just the beginning of translating many more of our tours to come. The Doors Open website does have a Spanish translation plugin as well. So people can read and access the materials that way as well.
All right. Well, Lydia, Grace, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and good luck on the event.
Thank you so much for having us, Joy.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great day.
Grace Feuer is the Events Director for Historic Milwaukee, and Lydia Villazayas is the Community Outreach Manager for the Silver City neighborhood with Via CDC, formerly known as Layton Boulevard West Neighbors. Doors Open will be this Saturday and Sunday, with locations throughout the city. And you can participate virtually with tours of a few different neighborhoods and buildings. You can find more information at WUWM.com. We're in the middle of our fall member drive here at WUWM. You can call 877-583-0309 or head to WUWM.com/give with your donation. You just heard me talking with some of the people behind this year's Doors Open. And Doors Open is one of the most cherished annual events here in Milwaukee because it teaches us about our history as a city, the places that make us the city we are, and the people behind all of it. That's what we strive to do every day here at WUWM. Teach you about what makes Milwaukee special, the stories that matter to our lives, and the people who make our community great. And we rely on your support to bring you those stories. Donate now to support that kind of coverage that illuminates the important stories in our city. Call 877-583-0309. That's 877-583-0309. You can go online at wuwm.com/give, or you can tap that red donate button in the WUWM app. Right now, we have a very special offer from Classy Girl Cupcakes. If you give right now during Lake Effect, you'll be automatically entered into a drawing to win a cupcake party tray from Classy Girl Cupcakes. The tray includes 26 cupcakes and your choice of up to 4 flavors. If you're someone who's gluten-free, if you're someone who's vegan,
don't worry about it. There are gluten-free and vegan options and more than 25 flavors that you can choose from. There are flavors like cookies and cream, almond, salted caramel fudge, lemon, among many others. A contribution is not necessary to be entered into the drawing, but would be greatly appreciated. If you give right now before 1 o'clock, you're automatically entered. Call 877-583-0309. You can head to our website, wuwm.com/give, or head to our app and just press that big red donate button. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how the nationwide nursing shortage is impacting hospitals here in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll speak with the local director and producer of the documentary Finding Lauren, premiering this weekend at the Bradley Symphony Center. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.